Before you listen to this podcast, you can subscribe to The Critic magazine with the current offer of 3 issues for just £5. Head to our website, www.thecritic.co.uk, to subscribe today. Hello, Critic listeners, and welcome to this week's podcast. He won a large majority in last December's election, but with his judgment and performance increasingly questioned, is Boris Johnson the wrong man to be leading government? Simon Heffer, Professor of Modern British History at Buckingham University and a columnist for the Sunday and Daily Telegraph, argues that the Prime Minister is unsuited to the job. And Graham Stewart also talks to Professor Jeremy Black, Senior Fellow at Policy Exchange, about how British history is taught at schools and universities. Is there still a national story?
It's been a difficult fortnight for Boris Johnson. Lackluster performances at Prime Minister's question times and at Downing Street's briefings, and then questions of judgment in his standing by his adviser, Dominic Cummings. Is this just passing turbulence in the midst of a storm that was not of his making, or is it a clearer sign yet that Boris Johnson is the wrong man? Simon Heffer, for this month's edition of The Critic, you have written an article about Boris Johnson, saying that he's the wrong man for this pandemic. But you've known him in a journalistic capacity for many years now, and you write of him, you say, the Prime Minister is an indolent man for whom the exercise of power is a recreation or an indulgence rather than a duty. Can you give instances from your experience to back up that damning verdict?
Well, I mean, certainly when he worked for me, there were occasions where he was supposed to be in the office doing some work and just didn't turn up. I well remember having a day off myself and watching a cricket match on a Friday because I had edited the paper the previous Sunday. And I got a telephone call from the subs at about 5 o'clock asking when I was coming to the office to sort the page out. And I said, well, I'm not. Boris is in charge. And he said, well, he's not here. And that's just one thing that sticks in the memory. He was notoriously unprofessional. I remember him not turning up at a party conference for several days because he had to write up an article. And it was an interview with Chris Patten that he'd been to Hong Kong to do. He'd been to Hong Kong 6 months earlier to do this interview and still hadn't written it up. And that was interesting for not turning up at this party conference in Blackpool. So, I mean, I could bore your listeners all day with stories of him, but just suffice it to say that he struck me as an entirely unprofessional, unserious person.
So how is it that someone with this record and attitude has found himself as the head of the British government?
Well, he's very good at taking people in. I mean, I remember after one incident, I was the editor of the Daily Telegraph asking Max Hastings, the editor, to sack him, and I was told by Hastings that he was someone who hadn't gone to the Gaiety of Nations and contributing a lot to the paper. I found these things hard to believe at the time. I found them impossible to believe now. And I now see Hastings writing all over the place, saying that he really wishes that he'd finish Johnson's career off when he had a chance to do so. So he's very good at manipulating people and very good at taking people in. And he is utterly unscrupulous. And will use that lack of scruple to just basically deceive people about his abilities. And this is all 25 years ago. He may have had a magic transformation since I last worked with him, but I very much doubt it. And the fact that he needed, I think, 8 deputy mayors to be mayor of London suggests that he's still not somebody who applies himself properly to the job. And I think what we've seen in the last few days, his addiction to Dominic Cummings. Everybody says, well, what has Dominic Cummings got on him? Well, I don't think Dominic Cummings has got anything on him. I think Dominic Cummings is simply the man who runs the government. And Johnson knows that if he doesn't have Cummings there, the government won't run.
And so when we're hearing rumours that Dominic Cummings actually might go of his own volition at the end of the year, once the Brexit transition period comes to a close, I mean, that may just be a smokescreen to throw us off the scent now, but if that were to happen, How do you see things panning out for the Prime Minister?
Well, I believe Cummings going with his own volition when I see it. I think if Cummings left, Johnson would really struggle, because not least on, it appears, Cummings's recommendation, he has appointed possibly the most untalented cabinet in British political history. I mean, I am a historian. I can't think of any cabinet that has had fewer highly qualified, highly intelligent, highly able people in it than this one. And that appears to be a deliberate ploy by Johnson and Cummings to maintain control of people. And when you see the way that cabinet ministers have been wheeled out obediently over the last few days to say how absolutely marvellous Cummings is and how, of course, he didn't break any rules at all by doing what he did, you understand immediately why it's useful to this government to have patsies sitting in the cabinet. But if you have patsies sitting in the cabinet, when things get really difficult and decisions, important decisions have to be taken, these people are not able to do it. And you know, to an extent, we've seen this during this present crisis, because there doesn't appear to have been any serious analysis by any ministers of what should be done in terms of scientific advice. I know that most cabinet ministers don't have a science degree, but most of them are supposed to be intelligent, able people who can evaluate advice and decide whether or not it's the right thing to do. Now, I think one reason we had lockdown so late is that a decision was taken not to have lockdown, and then there was a panic, and Johnson and Cummings said, well, we better have lockdown. And it was either better to do it immediately or probably like not do it at all. But again, there was no cabinet. They weren't consulted. You know, one hears this. And they simply weren't consulted. There was no cabinet input to take that decision or to make that decision watertight. So if Cummings goes and Johnson's thrown back on the so-called abilities of his cabinet, he's either going to have a cabinet reshuffle and bring in people who will challenge him and who have minds of their own, or he's going to have to go to hell in a handcart. It's one or the other.
A prime minister can only deal with the hand of cards he has. Is the weak cabinet, as you see it, just a reflection of a dearth of talent in the senior ranks of the party at the moment?
Well, that's certainly true to an extent, although there are people on the back benches who, I won't name them before you ask me because I didn't really know their political careers, but there are people on the back benches who are highly able. Some of them have held office already and didn't do a bad job in holding office. And, of course, they've been either kept out of government or they've been kept in the lower reaches of the government precisely because they do have that experience and intellectual ability to challenge a third-rate prime minister and his third-rate advisers. So I don't think it's entirely the fault of the Tory party. Also, there's a lot of people in the House of Lords who are quite good, and in a national crisis such as this, I don't think anybody would object to not a couple of ministers coming from the House of Lords and are doing a good job in the cabinet. But again, that doesn't appear to be considered.
You said he's picked deliberately a weak cabinet, and that cabinet hasn't dealt effectively with the scientific advice it received. But I wonder whether previous cabinets might also have struggled. I mean, there weren't, from memory, a very large number of science degrees in either John Major's or Margaret Thatcher's cabinets. They might, too, have struggled to grasp what is, by any measure, a very difficult pandemic to deal with.
Well, let's not forget Mrs. Thatcher herself had a science degree from Oxford, so she would never admit that on that front. But as I said earlier, it's not about having a science degree, it's about having common sense and deliberative powers and experience to sit down and work out what to do with the advice you get. And there's too much evidence from the last couple of months that the government has simply borne the impression of the last scientist to sit on it, which is why they changed their minds over lockdown. Now, lockdown may have been the right thing to do, but if that is the case, or was the case, it should have happened at once. It shouldn't have happened, you know, quite some time in, as it did. And So it's not about having a science degree. It's about having a sense of authority as a cabinet minister to contribute to discussions and to challenge decisions. And I simply don't think this cabinet is up to that.
That may be, but let's assume we have a cabinet reshuffle and some of the talent that you see on the back benches is promoted. And let's assume that the Prime Minister finds himself challenged in cabinet in the future. Looking at his character, how would he cope, do you think, with being challenged and with dealing with serious advice? Is he someone who can actually take advice, or is he indifferent to it?
Well, the officer can take advice, because otherwise Cummings wouldn't be so powerful as he is. Johnson does nothing, apparently, but take advice from Cummings. And why Cummings should uniquely be the man that Johnson has decided is the most brilliant man in Britain to do this is beyond me, and I think beyond most people who look at the way this government is operating. And you only have to see one of Cummings's, I believe, more recent decisions, which is about this insane 14-day quarantine. And to impose the quarantine now is mad. To impose it on people who are, generally speaking, healthy is mad. And you will destroy the travel industry once and for all, particularly the aviation industry, if it persists, because nobody who wants to take a two-week holiday has got 6 weeks free if they're going back to work to take a two-week holiday, 2 weeks to quarantine when they get where they're going, 2 weeks to have their holiday, and then 2 weeks to quarantine when they come back. So he does take advice, but he doesn't seem to bother to evaluate it. What I think is happening at the moment, and I get this from talking to a number of Conservative MPs over the last two or three weeks, is that the way he has run this has caused the scales to fall from their eyes. You only have to see the last number. It's about a quarter of the backbenchers who have come up publicly and said that Cummings has behaved wrongly and badly. These are people who no longer worry about confronting the Prime Minister and about disagreeing with him. And they no longer worry about it because they know they have their emperor's clothes moment. They've seen that while he might technically have achieved Brexit, although I believe that when we actually leave, finally, at the end of the year, if we leave at the end of the year, that he isn't actually any good at doing anything else. And I had a long conversation while I was researching the piece for the Critic with a very senior peer who had not only given money to Johnson's campaign as for leadership, but had helped raise money for it. And his disillusion was unbelievable. He said, I hadn't realized he was so utterly incapable of doing anything else. And so what will happen if he has a cabinet reshuffle and people start challenging him is he will become less and less self-confident. The country will look at the Conservative Party and become more and more aware, even that it is now, after recent events, that it is not well run. And the Conservative Party on the backbenches will start to talk about whether they've got the right leader. Now, I'm not for a moment saying there's going to be a leadership contest this year or possibly even next year. But the erosion of his reputation as a leader is underway. It has started. And it's not looking good for him. And I suppose if things get really bad for him, really difficult, he might even decide to do an Anthony Eaton and just say, well, I'm going on a cruise and not coming back for a long time. I don't know. But certainly the easiest days of his premiership are over. And he will not recover from this easily in the eyes of the British public, and they will have a vote when the next election comes, because not least he won't recover easily from this in the eyes of his own party.
One last question, if I may, Professor Heffer. Many of the faults that you find in Boris Johnson, might you not also have made them to President Reagan, who was not a hard-working man, be fair to say, lazy in a number of ways, didn't confront some truths close to home, but was a very successful two-term president?
Well, I spent some time in Washington during the second term of Reagan's presidency, and he did run a form of cabinet government. People who served in Reagan's administration had an input into what was going on, and he was very good at taking their advice. Reagan knew that he was, to an extent, a front man, what presidents are, But he also knew that there were people around him who were cleverer than he was, more experienced in politics than he was, and at taking political executive decisions than he was. And he relied on them. And he did a pretty good job, as you have said. But what Reagan didn't do was have one man sitting in Downing Street giving him orders, or in his case, the White House, giving him orders about what he should do and how he should run the country. It was a much more collegiate atmosphere. And I think what we have seen that has been so damaging to this country in the last 6 or 8 weeks is a complete absence of cabinet government. Don't take my word for it. Look at any of the big reports that have been done, particularly in Sunday papers, over the last 6 or 8 weeks. You've got one cabinet minister after another saying, we're not consulted, we're not taken seriously, we're not brought into these conversations. And you have a cabinet for a purpose. It isn't just that each minister runs his or her own department. It's also that they contribute to a collegiate discussion to try and reach the best possible policy. Now, it seems the only discussion that's happened of any note in cabinet in recent days has been an order going out from Boris Johnson and or Dominic Cummings to go out and defend Dominic Cummings. Now, if that's the limit of what the cabinet is there for, we're finished.
Well, Professor Heffer, your article, Boris's Corona Catastrophe, is in this month's edition of The Critic magazine. As ever, really illuminating to talk to you, and thank you very much.
Thank you very much indeed.
Well, the teaching of British history is a central area of the cultural wars and the battlegrounds, both in the classroom and more widely. Jeremy Black, you were one of the advisors serving on the committee that framed the national curriculum. What were the parameters of framing British history at school level, and how is that changing?
Well, yes, I sat on the committee that helped revise it in the early two teens when Michael Gove was Secretary of State for Education. I think, first of all, that once you have a national curriculum, which was a development, obviously, that is associated with the Kenneth Baker in the late 20th century, once you have a national curriculum, clearly that focuses even more attention on, as it were, the political element of what one might call history wars. History wars were a phrase used to describe the way in which the teaching of history and the presentation of the nation's past appeared to be increasingly politicized in the late 20th century. And indeed, history seems of all the subjects to be the most contentious. Michael Gove told me when he was Secretary of State for Education that the subject on which the department received the most representation from members of the public about the teaching thereof was in fact history, followed by English, but he said with history having a clear lead. And as we can see at any one moment, whether we are dealing with the specific, as it were, issues such as decolonization, which we've already described on the Critic Online, or indeed more general questions as to what ought to be included and what is reasonable to expect young people to know at particular ages, these are issues on which people have very different opinions.
And did Michael Gove share with you the nature of the correspondence he received? Were people complaining that there wasn't enough traditional British history, kings and queens and battles and so on, or were they wanting a broader social and cultural history?
Well, people very rarely writing to government or any other institution in order to offer praise, but I think it's fair to say that there was a sense of uneasiness about the extent to which part of the teaching of the past seemed to leave a very episodic account of British history and in sometimes a negative account. And I think it's fair to say that that remains an anxiety at the present day. One can see, for example, the recent controversy about the idea that the Mayflower settlement of Massachusetts should not be celebrated because it represented a stage in the slave trade, et cetera, which of course is complete rubbish. It didn't. And obviously there's a big difference between elements that are within the education system, which are, shall we say, offering a particularly partisan account, and the situation when you just have ordinary members of the public making remarks that might be regarded as vacuous or ill-informed.
And on that point of cultural wars, which, if anything, have intensified in the last few years, is it even really acceptable now to talk about British history in a singular term? Should we be, or are we being asked to think of it as British histories, as if that there is not one cohesive narrative?
Well, that's a very good question. I mean, the notion of British histories, of what was called for a while Four Nations history, was one that developed several decades ago and was clearly linked to the rise of, in particular, Scottish separatism, Scottish nationalism, if you like. And that enjoyed a certain amount of traction. I mean, it has its limitations. I've written a number of histories of the British Isles and of Britain, and what I've pointed out in them is that one of the problems with Four Nations history is that you end up, for example, devoting far too little attention to different experiences within England. I mean, England proportionately, certainly even more the case since the Irish famine of the mid-19th century, is overwhelmingly is numerically proportionate, and it does seem slightly bizarre that you, as it were, should give so much more weight to, or might give so much more weight to, the history of Scotland than, shall we say, to the history of the Midlands in England. But, you know, those would be a matter of opinion, and obviously Scots listening to this will not concur. But I think that your basic point, which is that offering, as it were, history as a cacophony of competing voices does not make it easier for people to see a central narrative, is true. And on top of that, there are analytical points that are the case whichever part of the British Isles or of Britain or whatever, the United Kingdom, or whatever unit you wish to offer. So, for example, over the last 150 years, we have seen secularization, we've seen urbanization, we've seen the growth of government, we've seen changing attitudes towards women, the young, we've seen ethnic change. Now, these are all elements that are the case, whichever part of the British Isles you're talking about, and then if you exclude the Republic of Ireland, all parts of the United Kingdom were involved in World War II. They were all part of what was a colonial or imperial power, and they were therefore all involved in decolonization. They were all involved in relative economic transformation, and in some cases decline. So all of these are points that are germane, whatever you are going to talk about in terms of Britons. And I do think there's a degree of faddishness. And I also think that, I mean, in a way, history is interesting because it is so porous a subject. It is one that is so open to everybody's views and opinions. I mean, as we know, you only need a medical controversy, MMR, for example, and you will have a whole host of so-called experts shooting up who are in fact just shooting their prejudices out. But history exemplifies that more than most, and you will notice that the BBC, that sort of rather egregious custodian of the nation's memory, it would like to think, is quite happy to offer anybody up as a historian, as long as they locate a prejudice selected to be in the past.
And I wonder, though, whether if we look at the fracturing of the central narrative, we can look at Scottish and other Celtic nationalisms and different experiences through immigration and so on. But there's also one other thing which has acidically eaten away in that, and it's actually in many ways associated with some Tory historians, and that is an attack on the Whig interpretation of history, this idea that British history is a progress, at any rate from the period of the Glorious Revolution in 1688-89, a series of wise and benevolent reforms leading to Britain's status as top nation. I wonder whether the more historians have picked apart that narrative, that they've made a cohesive teaching of British history almost impossible.
Well, that's fascinating. Let me just tell you several points you make there. First of all, when you use that phrase top nation, I mean, that is a caricature of the Whig approach, as you know. And I'm not a Whig, but even the Whig historians were well aware that there were contrasting elements of British history and of the British present, whether it was located in terms of politics or another topic that interested them greatly, which of course is religion. So the idea that in the past there was some sort of homogenous entity which was held up to have existed and that there has therefore been a complete failing from that, no, I wouldn't go that far. But what I would say is that history as understood as a chronological process, that in other words you should encourage people to have some sort of sense in this country, the world, whatever unit you wish to choose, as to why and how it is different than 500, 1,000, 1,500 and 2,000, I think that was more significantly a part of the teaching of the subject at both school and university, and indeed, for example, museums or galleries, than the present approach, which is increasingly a sort of hodgepodge account of the past, in which you are offered documents, texts, exhibits in museums, without really much understanding of context, and in the idea being that these themselves and understanding these illuminate history, which I think is a very difficult account. So to me, the problem is not so much whether we have or whether we have or have dismantled a Whig superstructure and underlying structure. The problem for me is that most people do not have a clear idea of change that has occurred through time. We can then debate, if you like, or use as a teaching tool a discussion of what that meant for particular people. But, you know, it is helpful if people understand that, you know, the Victorian age was 1837 to 1901, that during that period we were a major industrial and imperial power, that we extended the franchise, that what this meant, etc., etc. You know, all of those remarks do not need to take a particular tone, but I mean, I would argue that there is value in adopting a expectation of content. Now, you also ask the very separate question, which is, have the academics' destructiveness, which is what you were implying, and I wouldn't necessarily disagree with you, though I would make that more complex, had the academics' destructiveness, as it were, contaminated the public understanding of history? And I would say, well, I think that possibly exaggerates the importance and self-importance of academics. I would think that most students at school level who, as it were, are taught history are more affected by the issues and ideas of the teachers that communicate with them. And I'm not so sure that those people have always been necessarily tremendously influenced by academic history as opposed to being influenced by particular pedagogic ideas and a sort of, you know, a strand of what is taught in PGCs and B.Eds and the equivalent. So, you know, I'm not got any particular briefing for what I think is often been a very foolish approach to national history at the level of universities, with on the whole a failure to engage adequately with politics, with high politics in particular, with foreign policy, with the role of religion, with an often very faddish aspect of identity politics. I think those are all, that is all a reasonable charge, but I think the major failing is of the school level, because most people doing history will never read a book by a university historian. And in many cases, that's very wise of them, because those books are often hedged around with so much to do with methodology that they're rather difficult even for specialists to follow.
Has this methodological approach at university level started to manifest itself, though, in school textbooks?
But to a degree, I mean, you know, I put it to you, Graham, have you ever read, I unfortunately have, because I had to write a couple of books on historiography, some of the absolute nonsense pushed out by the British academic exponents of postmodernism. Now, that stuff is really difficult to follow. I don't think anybody could really expect a 14-year-old to pick it up. I mean, what I think the problem is, we think back to the sort of age of, you know, the history boys and the idea of enlightened school teachers encouraging really bright boys and girls to be interested in the past. And many of the, you know, when I was did A-level, you know, I read the works of major academics. I think and fear today that most academics are not writing for that wider audience. I mean, you tell me what you think either of the Regius professors at Cambridge have contributed to the national debate, and I think we would have a yawning hole in our conversation. We could then move on to the professors of modern history at Oxford or Cambridge. We could move on to the professors of medieval history at Oxford and Cambridge. So actually, I think it's there is a yawning gap there rather than, as it were, a concerted ploy or policy. There may well be too much weight given to certain people writing on historiography, conceptualization, methodology. But my own view is that that tends to have less weight at the academic level than often the writers of it anticipate. But that's just my own personal view.
Is there a school of thought which would say that actually what the great professors at the fine universities are writing in a way doesn't matter beyond the campus or the, you know, the college court or quad anymore? Because actually, if you asked people in the country to name a historian, a British historian, they would probably say Simon Sharma or Dan Jones or Dan Snow even. And these popularisers, I don't necessarily say that in a negative way, these people who are able to convey, particularly Simon Sharma, who obviously is a leading historian, able to convey to a broader audience, actually still have that very broad impact.
Well, first of all, let's again unpick that. I agree with you entirely, and indeed, you know, if you look at my books on historiography, I have argued consistently that what I call public history is more important than academic history. So I agree with you. I think that was always the case, and I think certainly at the present day, both television historians, as you mentioned, and also brilliantly persuasive writers of more, shall we say, sort of narrative biographical types, Andrew Roberts, Simon Heffer, are, I think, infinitely having greater weight than a lot that comes out of the academy. So yes, I agree with you entirely. As far as British history is concerned, there are some common flaws, though. I mean, I referred earlier to the failure to really engage adequately with the regional dimension within England, and I think that that is a common flaw. And you mentioned Simon Sharma. I mean, I wrote a review on both the first two series of his history. I thought that was very Whiggish, and in a way very dated. So I'm not sure I would hold that up for praise. But of course, he is a very different generation. I mean, you know, the Dan Jones, Dan Snows, James Hollands of this world are, you know, people of below 60. I think Simon Sharma's, what, mid-70s? So he, in a sense, is a very different generation.
And what would you recommend, were you an advisor to the government now, in terms of what should be done at school level? Do we need a sort of Plato to NATO, or in this case, Bede to Brexit, grand grand narrative, particularly in the early years of schooling, so that children get a sense of the chronology of events? Or is there not time for that? And actually, given that there are only a few hours a week devoted to history, the modular approach, for all its failings, is actually the only option.
Well, I personally think you need three levels. You need the local, the national, and the world. I think you can vary the intensity of those depending upon which stage of the school career they're at. As you say, there are only a certain number of hours, but you are talking about quite a few years. I think that chronological framework is key. Within that, you can obviously focus on particular issues. It seems to me rather bizarre to look at the 19th century without focusing in particular on economic growth, for example. But I think that the modular approach doesn't work. It leaves people with assorted fragments, and it's rather like an oil painting in which people have painted in thickly little micro bits, but have left large parts of the canvas blank.
Well, Professor Black, we have to leave it there, but as ever, thank you very much for your insight.
My pleasure.
If you've enjoyed listening to The Critic podcast, why not subscribe to have the magazine delivered to your door? Subscribe today with the offer of 3 issues for just £5 by heading to our website, www.thecritic.co.uk.